Well, thank you very much. I thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference and give me the opportunity to talk about our work. So I have decided to include actually not only conformal symmetry, but also the universe and also beyond, all the way to the electroweak scale as part of the work that we have been doing. My collaborators in this work are Holden Chan and Neil Turok and Paul Schleinhardt. And there is some of the work has already appeared, and there is a lot more to appear that we have done that we haven't had a chance to write. And also additional work, in particular related to the electroweak scale, that is also in progress. So the outline of this talk is basically, it will start with just gravity coupled to a scalar field, the usual normal gravity coupled to a scalar field. And then what we have done in this work that we have done is that we have managed to find the complete set of analytic solutions to the cosmological equations. By that I mean the Friedmann equations coupled to a scalar. And this is in the case of some special potentials. So, and in this, in these solutions, we have included also curvature, spatial curvature, radiation, as well as other things that I will mention as we go along. To be able to do this work, we used a bunch of tricks having to do with conformal symmetry, which I will outline. And then we have solved several models, meaning several potentials for the scalar field. And then in these solutions, we have no restrictions at all on the values of the parameters in the potential or on the boundary conditions. So unlike other approaches in cosmology in which you pick a potential and then you pick only one solution to describe cosmology, in this case, we have all the solutions, and then we try to take advantage of the fact that we have all the solutions to learn some things that are not possible without this knowledge. In particular, what we will see is that most of the solutions, the generic solutions, are geodesically incomplete. So if you start anywhere from the universe and try to go backward for a particle, so you are going to find out that you hit the singularity in a finite amount of time. And so the universe, the geometry is geodesically incomplete, and then most of the discussion stops there because we don't know what to do. So in this case, we will learn, by knowing all the solutions, we will find a way for how to complete the geometry and turn it into a geodesically complete universe. And in this, conformal symmetry is going to play a major role. And then we will find that there are bounces at zero size of the universe, where the universe will go through a big crunch and then go through a big bang after that by bouncing at zero size. And there are also solutions at finite size, but much fewer solutions. We will also learn how to go through the cosmological singularity and find out what there is on the other side of the cosmological singularity. And in doing that, we found a model-independent solution which is an attractor to the origin and makes forces the fields, all the fields that are involved, to behave in a particular way. As you go towards the singularity, there is this attractor solution which is model-independent. That is, it does not depend on the potential. And in this attractive solution, anisotropy of the metric, like we were talking, one of the speakers was talking earlier, Karlip was talking earlier about the Kasner type of metric. This kind of metric plays a very important role in providing this attractive solution. And it is unique. So through that, we found out how you go through a big crunch and then into a big bang. And then in this transition, there is a period of time during which the universe goes through an anti-gravity period. And so this is unavoidable in classical GR. So it's something that we found you cannot avoid it. So after all of this, after describing all of this, I will also try to take advantage of the general behavior of the solutions once you get away from the singularity, and we'll try to connect that to the hierarchy problem for how it is possible to generate cosmologically, how it is possible to generate very different scales, such as the electroweak versus the Planck scale, in a theory which includes the standard model coupled to gravity. And in this also we will see that the dark energy plays a role in providing such big scales. All right, so that's the outline. So what we are discussing is cosmology with a standard theory of this type. So the Einstein-Hilbert term, kinetic term, and then a potential term to which we will add radiation and matter. And then we will allow that there will be curvature and also anisotropy. So if we start with the FRW metric without anisotropy, but with curvature, then the Friedmann equations that you derive from this action are the standard Friedmann equations where well, there is the scale factor A, which appears as part of the metric. And we will be discussing it in conformal time. So instead of usual time, we will go to conformal time. And so these equations are written in conformal time. So the potential that appears in these equations is going to be a special potential. It's going to be this particular potential, which is a cos to the 4 plus a sinh to the 4 of the field with coefficients, dimensionless coefficients B and C that appear there. The shape of this potential, depending on the size of B and C, is either a, you know, just a well potential or a double well potential. So in other words, it's kind of a standard looking potential. Now we managed to find, as I said, the complete set of solutions for these equations, for this potential, but also for this other potential, as well as for this other potential with arbitrary parameters.
How did we come up with that potential?
You will see. You will see why. You will. It will pop up in a very natural way. So now, as I mentioned, the generic solution of these equations is geodesically incomplete at the Big Bang. But there are a subset of geodesically complete solutions, but provided I put some conditions on initial values or on the parameters of the potential. So with some set of conditions, then it is possible to find geodesically complete solutions, but this is going to be a set of measure zero. It is not going to be the generic solution. In other words, if you want to believe this is the way the universe works, then there will be a measure problem. Okay. So now, however, when you go near the Big Bang, it is very, very important that you must include anisotropic matrix, because anisotropy is going to dominate over the potential. So we need to take that into account, and so we play with the Kasner metric in the case of the flat universe, or with the Bianchi 9 or Bianchi 8 matrix for curved spaces, which are the analog of the Kasner potential, but it includes a curvature parameter. So this guy is for positive curvature, this guy is for negative curvature. So when you do that, then we include in the Kasner, in such matrix, we include two more fields in the metric. So in other words, we don't take, say, the Kasner metric with fixed parametrization of time, but we take it with fields. And so we allow the fields to interact with the others, and then we solve for their behavior. Okay, so now I mentioned this geodesic incompleteness of the theory. Now, in order to understand better how the incompleteness arises, and also how to cure it, how to find the completion, we will begin to work with a slightly extended theory as compared to Einstein's theory that I just wrote, in which we are going to extend Einstein's theory with an additional local scale symmetry, which is called the Weyl symmetry. So now, once you require a local Weyl symmetry, then you cannot allow any dimensionful couplings, including the gravitational constant, the Newton constant, you cannot allow that. So there is no standard Hilbert-Einstein term if you require that the theory should be invariant under Weyl symmetry. However, what the Weyl symmetry does, so this is the transformation. So local scalings of two fields that I have here, and then optometric. So what such transformations do allow is conformally coupled scalars. So conformally coupled scalars are perfectly happy, and so here is, I have two scalars, phi and s. They couple to r. I will explain this relative minus sign in a minute. So, but the way it works is that, let me forget about s for the time being. Let me start with the first scalar by itself. So if you want this first scalar that is going to play the role of the gravitational constant, like an effective gravitational constant, if you want that to be positive, then the Weyl symmetry requires that the kinetic term associated with that scalar to have the wrong sign of the kinetic energy. In other words, it is a ghost. So Weyl symmetry requires that if that coefficient is to be positive, then the corresponding field is a ghost. So it appears that there is a problem. However, there is a Weyl symmetry. There is a local symmetry. Because there is a local symmetry, I can choose, under such rescaling, I can choose phi to just be a constant. I can work in a gauge in which phi is just a constant. So when phi is just a constant, then there is no ghost. Obviously, this is no longer a degree of freedom. And that term, phi squared, just becomes the gravitational constant. That constant, phi, takes the meaning of the gravitational constant. So that's for the first phi, and then we are back to Einstein-Hilbert term, just by itself. So now I want to add matter to that. So when I add matter, let's start with a scalar. If I add matter, that scalar can no longer be a ghost. There is no longer gauge symmetry for it not to be a ghost. So therefore, it must come with the correct sign of the kinetic energy, but then the Weyl symmetry requires that it must come with the opposite sign compared to that ghost. And therefore, there is a relative minus sign between the first scalar that I call phi and then any other additional scalars that I will keep adding to this theory. If you want even more scalars, you can add them just like the S, put an index I on the S, and then put an index I on this S and sum up over I. So then finally, a potential term. Again, for the Weyl symmetry to work out, you see there is the square root of g, which is going to rescale, and also a potential that is going to rescale. For that to be invariant, you can only choose it, let's say, by pulling out a factor of phi to the 4 in front of some function, where that function can only depend on the ratio of the fields. So that function is Weyl invariant, and then the phi to the 4 will cancel the rescaling of the square root of g. All right, so this is the setup if you start from an extension of Einstein theory with a Weyl symmetry. So now, this form of the action actually is very well motivated from different points of views. It came as a prediction of what I've been calling two-time physics in the form of two-time gravity. I don't have the time to tell you about that. But what it is, in very few words, it's an extension of ordinary 3+1 dimensional physics by an additional huge gauge symmetry. So in other words, you are adding only gauge degrees of freedom to one-time physics, but in such a way that all of physics is rewritten directly in 4+2 dimensions. This 4+2 dimensions is actually behind conformal symmetry, what you call SO4, 2 in ordinary 3+1 dimensions is nothing but the Lorentz symmetry of 4+2. So there is a lot of stuff that I can talk about, in fact, about conformal symmetry being related to this directly, but I will leave it aside, and I will only mention one aspect, which is the Weyl symmetry. And the Weyl symmetry is simply a leftover, it's a leftover over from general coordinate transformations in the extra 1+1 dimensions. It is the transformation of the extra dimensions into the usual 3+1 dimensions, So it's a leftover symmetry which appears in this gauge fixed version of two-time gravity. It appears in the form of a wide symmetry. So it comes directly from something deeper, but it is also motivated from other points of views. In this work of Curie, Seiberg, Steinhardt, and Turok, that developed a view of the universe in the form of colliding brains. And in that approach, also, this action comes out, well, you can make it to come out, plus this work by McFadden and Turok, you can make it, you can rewrite it in such a way to look like exactly like that, which is the reason why we started to collaborate.
It is a well-known trick, right? In supergravity literature, this is used all the time.
Which one again?
Supergravity literature, constructing supergravity.
But not with the condition that the scalars, that all scalars must come as conformal scalars. And in supergravity literature, you can add a compensator, yeah, if you like, true. But again, there are conditions of this type that I have just mentioned, which are not in the supergravity literature.
And then typically the spectrum contains conformally coupled scalars as well.
I can go into the details of how it differs from ordinary supergravity literature. There are some differences. There are some additional constraints. I mean, the differences are in the form of constraints. It restricts more.
But then the action that you're on the first line, it's just the same. It's the same.
In fact, I wanted to say all of that as well, that if I choose the gauge that I mentioned in the very beginning, this extra term looks very much like the Kähler potential in supergravity theories. So therefore, the type of theory that I'm talking about is quite typical. Okay, so therefore, the results that I'm going to get out of here is not results of a weird theory. It is really the typical theory.
Mm-hmm. Don't you have to worry about possible anomalies?
Maybe one anomaly in the theory. Good idea. Good comment. If you look at the Weyl anomaly, it turns out this relative minus sign, if you have only two scalars, I believe it cancels. And there is no Weyl anomaly because of the relative minus sign. All right, so anyway, so now what I want to do.
I don't think it's true because in the one loop diagram, the minus signs cancel out. So the phi and the s will get the same sign. Mm.
Okay. In any case, you can always build a theory with more. You know, you can complete the theory into something that will not have the Weyl anomaly, and this is just a subset of that theory. So I want to concentrate on the part which is of interest for this talk. All right. So now what I want to do is begin to use this Weyl symmetry in order to make gate choices, which is not necessarily just the one that I mentioned initially. So in particular, I can make a gate choice in such a way that this whole thing in front of R is a constant. We will call that the Einstein gauge. So if I do that, that means as a function of x, the phi, and I'm putting a sub e to indicate that I am in the Einstein gauge. So in the Einstein gauge, phi and s are therefore look like Horsch and Sinch, so that their difference is a constant. So in other words, I'm introducing a field sigma in order to parameterize that gauge. And then if you take this and plug it back in, you get back to the usual Einstein version with an arbitrary potential because to begin with, I had an arbitrary function. So therefore, the standard theory that I'm investigating is the usual theory, but I want to take advantage of this gauge symmetry in order to actually find solutions. I will use that as a trick.
So to use this, you can only do this parameterization if phi squared is greater than s squared.
Very good comment. In fact, we will go into that.
Okay.
Okay, exactly. We will go into that. And that's the next comment.
Oh, okay.
So this is not the whole story, right? So the Einstein gauge is valid only in the patch of space-time, where a gauge invariant quantity such as this one, which includes phi squared minus s squared, is positive. If it's not positive, then there is more to the theory. And the question for me coming from two-time physics, started actually with this particular question. Is the dynamics going to require that this, the sign of this quantity is a function of time or is a function of space-time, could change? Is the dynamics going to require that? Or will I be able to stay only in the positive sector because the dynamics will never require me to do that? So I kept asking cosmologists for about a few years. And nobody could answer it until I finally did answer it. So the answer is that, in fact, this generically does change sign. For most of the potentials, it does generically change sign. And therefore, we go into a period or a space-time region in which anti-gravity emerges. And so now, the only way to prevent that from doing so is to say that your space is geodesically incomplete. But then you are giving up something else. You are giving up possible knowledge about what this could mean. All right. So therefore, this is what we started to investigate, and how we found all these solutions. So the initial purpose for looking for solutions was to answer this question, but then it became interesting in cosmology. All right, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work in another gauge that we call gamma gauge. In the gamma gauge, I will label all the fields with a sub-index gamma. And what I will do for the case of only time-dependent fields, in the case of cosmology, I will take the scale factor to be 1. Okay, so if I take the scale factor to be 1, then the Friedman, Robertson-Walker universe looks like this, except that the overall factor, a squared, is missing because it's been set equal to 1. The curvature is just a constant. It's not time dependent. And then the Lagrangian, that Lagrangian, for the purpose of discussing cosmology, just reduces to a ghost plus the scalar. The curvature term is that one with the phi squared minus s squared in front of it, and then the potential. And then plus there is an energy constraint, which is equivalent to one of the Einstein equations, which simply says that the Hamiltonian derived from this Lagrangian must be set equal to 0. So now, if it were not for this constraint, if you look at this Lagrangian and take a special potential, which I will do, like phi to the 4 plus s to the 4, purely quartic potential, you will see what the special thing that's going to happen. But before I do that, let me also mention how you go from this gauge, from the gamma gauge, to the Einstein gauge. The relation is that the scale factor in the Einstein gauge, the usual factor, is in fact proportional to phi squared minus s squared. So if this guy vanishes, that's when a squared vanishes. So the Big Bang in the Einstein gauge occurs when phi squared is equal to s squared in the gamma gauge. Because remember, in the Einstein gauge, phi squared minus s squared was just a constant. But in the gamma gauge, it is a function. And that's how you get the scale factor. And then the sigma is related to the ratio of phi and s. So this is what I just said, that the Big Bang singularity is going to occur when this gauge invariant thing vanishes. But because it is gauge invariant, it will vanish in every gauge, not only in the Einstein gauge. All right, so now how to get the analytic solutions is that I just showed you the Lagrangian. If I take a special case of this function f such that I have purely quartic potentials, then you can see it becomes the Lagrangian of decoupled phi and s. They are just decoupled from one another, and this is why that particular potential. So the equations of motion can be solved. Because they are decoupled, they can be solved easily. The first integral of the phi equation just says this combination of kinetic energy and potential energy is a constant. That's the first integral. And then similarly for the S. And then if you look at the energy, zero energy condition, it just says that one factor that involves phi is replaced by a constant, which is this E phi. Another factor that depends on S is replaced by another constant. And then if there is radiation, there is an additional constant in such a way that the sum of the whole thing is zero. So it just says that this energy, the energy in the phi field, must equal to the energy of the S field plus the energy of radiation. So this is how the equations will be solved. So namely, first find the solutions of decoupled equations, and then require that their energies are solved. But this is a very simple problem. It just is the problem of a particle in a potential in which it is solved at some energy level, and then another one at some energy level. These are just not so, the potentials are not so difficult, and then you can just solve it. But let's see what the parameter space is. The parameter space includes the parameters of the potential, B and C, the curvature constant, the radiation, this energy, which is one of the integration constants, is like an initial value. And then there would be, you see, because I'm solving differential equations, there are two initial values for phi and two initial values for S, so altogether four of them. But I have one condition that relates one of the initial values, so therefore one parameter goes away. And the other one, the whole thing is translationally invariant under tau, so therefore one other parameter can be chosen arbitrarily, so therefore there are only two remaining parameters related to initial values. All right, so therefore I am in a space of six parameters, and we find the analytic solutions that look somewhat different in 25 different regions of the parameter space. But they are all oscillating functions, and you will see in a minute why. I'm taking a very special case here of potentials in which I will take k to be zero so that I can plot something very simple. So V is a quartic. So V, this is the potential V for S. And then V for phi is also quartic, and it depends on whether it is an upward-looking potential or downward-looking potential. It depends on the sign of B. So now if I let me start with the S. So S, if it is given, if I'm working with a given some energy value, so all that will happen in this well, S will just oscillate back and forth forever. So it is an oscillating function. It's a function of time. Similarly, if B is negative, the phi is also an upward looking well. It must be at a higher energy level, and then it will oscillate as well forever, back and forth. So it is another oscillating function. And then if you try to find out what they are, including the parameter k, they are just Jacobi elliptic functions. So you can solve them, and you have analytic expressions for them. Now, because they are oscillating functions, phi squared minus s squared can easily change sign. So generically, you know, phi squared minus s squared easily can change sign as long as phi can be larger than s for some period of time. And so this will happen, and it is most of the time this is what will happen. Now, you can find solutions in which it will not change sign. If you put some restrictions on initial conditions, for example, I can start s to start out and phi to start out together, okay, initially, so force them to start out initially together. So S, you can see, has a smaller amplitude. Phi has a larger amplitude. So then when S oscillates to its maximum and then come back to zero, if phi also comes back to zero at the same time, namely if their periods are related to one another, which is a choice of parameters, then you can remain with phi remaining always larger than S. So there is a subset of solutions, but it is a set of measure zero. Here I wrote down some expression in terms of elliptic functions. All the point I'm trying to make is that this is the special case in which it does not change sign, where I have put some conditions on the parameters just to show that it is possible. But as I said, the generic for generic initial conditions, phi squared minus s squared will change sign. And then a generic solution will look like this. This is the phi s plane. Yeah?
So, what is the meaning? What is the meaning of k equal to zero?
The spatial curvature.
Oh, that k
is
a spatial curvature.
That k is just a spatial curvature. Right. So this is the phi s plane. When phi is equal to s, you'll be at the 45 degree line. At anywhere on a 45 degree line, phi is equal to s. A generic solution, you can start it anywhere you like, and then it will cross the that 45 degree line at some time and then continue, and then come back, cross it again, and then cross it again, and cross it again, and it will keep crossing it, you know, many, many, many times. So therefore, if you take that as a cosmological model, definitely there will be periods during which there is gravity, and then periods during which there is anti-gravity.
What is the rough estimate of the period, say, when there is gravity?
Yeah, I will come to that. It will depend on the parameters, right? And I will use that eventually for connecting things to electroweak.
So when phi space is squared, are you worried about the strong coupling of tensor mode?
The strong coupling of what?
Tensor mode.
Of what?
Tensor modes.
Tensor modes. Okay. We have left them aside for now. We are working. In fact, only for this with the scale factor, but pretty soon I will include other modes, in particular the anisotropic modes. I will include, and they are very important. So now what does this look like? Now, remember, if you look at the equations, here are the equations. There is in these equations, or in this Lagrangian, there is no evidence of a singularity, right? When I was in the Einstein frame, and when A was becoming zero, there was a curvature that was blowing up. But in this form, in this gauge, there is no evidence of any singularity. So we have, in other words, we have found a set of variables, which are these phi and s, in which the behavior of the equations do not feel any singularity, and then do what I just told you.
I think tensor mode is strongly coupled, and you cannot ignore the higher
term. I will come to that. Okay, I will come to that. First, we'll start with anisotropy. All right. So for now, okay. So this is what is going on. So we do not see the curvature as far as the scale factor is concerned. So now this is what is going to allow us to complete the geometry. So namely, if I now follow both the geometry as well as the motion of a particle that reaches a singularity at points like that, well, you can decide, well, I'm going to stop because I'm going to define gravity to be only in the gravitational sector, only there and there. But I will not want to go into anti-gravity because my definition of Einstein's theory was only when phi squared minus s squared was positive. Good, you can do that, but then it is geodesically incomplete. So you have that sickness. Now, what if you allow these solutions, which is a complete set of solutions, to continue? So then what happens is that, there is an anti-gravity mode, and so we now have to look at it. Okay, we have to see what else should we take into account. But from this point of view, this can be compared, for example, to the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinate parametrization of the black hole, where you avoid the apparent singularity of the at the horizon, and then you get to complete the space. So this is a completion of space, of the field space in Einstein's theory by extending the domain of phi and s. Okay, so now, furthermore, what we are seeing is that the generic solution is actually always cyclic. It is always oscillating. So it is going to come back because of that. And then this seems to be, although it is true certainly for the potential for which we have solved these equations, but it seems probably it is also true for a generic potential if you figure out how to continue to the singularity.
So there's this analogy of yours is kind of interesting because there is this fuzzball scenario that Costas has talked about and Sammy Matter talks about. This basically tells you this is the wrong analogy from the quantum mechanical point of view, because although if you restrict to symmetric space time, then you can do another continuation. But quantum mechanically, there are many, many more states inside a black hole that you can tunnel to basically by Hawking entropy. So in fact, inside the horizon, you're much more likely to tunnel to those very anisotropic in homogeneous states.
Well, that's we are going to take anisotropy precisely.
Well, but and in homogeneous, yeah. But that's the thing that imposing symmetries could be dangerous because you might be missing most of the.
I did not impose any symmetry.
But it's homogeneous and. Isotropic.
Oh, homogeneous and isotropic. Sure,
yeah,
sure.
So,
yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I agree. So I'm going to discuss them. Okay, right. So now also to give you a little bit more sense of what the solutions are looking like, if I impose the condition that I want to stay only in the gravitational sector, so namely that I don't cross. I don't cross at arbitrary points these 45-degree lines, but I cross only at zero. So then the way that phi initially goes starts out at zero and grows, and then s also starts out initially at zero and grows. S oscillates with a smaller amplitude. Phi also oscillates with a larger amplitude. And then if I arrange the periods to match, okay, with an integer, then again, you know, phi squared always remains larger than s squared. So these are the special solutions. Okay, now another thing that I want to emphasize here is that phi, I drew it with a larger amplitude. What makes it to have a larger amplitude is the parameter b, the size of the parameter b versus the size of the parameter c. If the parameter b is very, 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 very small, this amplitude is going to become huge as compared to the parameter. To the oscillations of S. So therefore, the physics of S, its size, its oscillation size, will be controlled by C, let's say of order 1, but the physics of phi will be controlled by the parameter B, and when that is much, much smaller, then when you look at A squared, which is phi squared minus S squared, phi squared is the one that really dominates as far as cosmology is concerned, why S is the physics of S at a much lower energy scale. So this is what is going to relate to the weak versus Planck scales. Clouder, you have a question?
Well, yeah. When they both go through zero, then the one is not dominating the other. The answer is zero. And that may happen momentarily, repeatedly,
yes.
But that has no significance, you would claim?
No, when they are both zero is also when A squared is vanishing. So that's when you hit the Big Bang. So when they are both zero, that's when their difference is also zero.
Okay.
That's when you hit the Big Bang. So these points, this is the bang, and this is the crunch, and then followed by a bang. So these are the zero size bounces. Okay, so the universe comes to zero size and then bounces from zero size and keeps going. So, but these are the very special solutions, the subset of solutions, which is of measure zero as compared to the generic solutions. And so in the meantime, so this is what you extract for A. So A is going up and down, again, cyclically. And sigma is starting at infinity, and then it's slowly, very quickly becoming very, very small. And then the smallness of sigma, again, is related to these parameters B and C that I mentioned. So that it's possible to eliminate the time coordinate, the tau coordinate between phi and s, and then just plot s versus phi. So again, for these solutions, they both start out at zero, phi keeps growing while s keeps oscillating. And then phi turns around, the universe has extended up to a maximum and then begins to contract. So that means phi comes back while s continues to oscillate and then goes to the other side of this phi s and so on. So this is in the case of B negative. Now, if B is positive, then phi goes all the way to infinity. And then, so in other words, A grows all the way to infinity, like this, and then comes back from infinity. But again, cyclically. All right, so now we are hitting the singularity, so closer to the singularity, we must take anisotropy into account. Otherwise, we are missing a big effect. So here is the Kasner metric, is this. So in the direction of x or in the direction of y, in the direction of z, we have to put functions of time. So there are two independent functions of time that you can put. We are calling them alpha 1 and alpha 2 and parameterizing it in this way and consider them also as dynamical fields that will interact with the others, and then we want to solve the equations, including these as dynamical fields. And then if there is curvature, then we need to take this Bianchi matrix when there is curvature. So we take all of that into account. So in the Friedmann equations, there are two more fields. So these two these additional fields satisfy equations like this with a potential energy, where the potential energy, you can figure it out from the curvature of the matrix. So that's that potential energy. So this is the potential energy that gives rise to this mixed master universe. Now, however, when these guys are interacting with a scalar as well, so this mixed master universe can be avoided in a particular phase space of the scalars. You know, the mixed master happens to occur only in a very small region of the phase space. Once you are outside of this region, you avoid the mixed master. All right, so and then you can write down an effective action that captures all of these equations, including the scale factor and then the anisotropy fields, the potential field that we were talking about, and this additional potential that comes from the curvature. Now, however, let's take a look at this and rewrite, instead of derivatives, the velocities of the alpha 1 and alpha 2 fields, write them in terms of the canonical conjugates, in fact, for also the sigma field. So when you rewrite it, then this term will look like this, pi squared over a squared. So namely, momentum over a squared for the sigma, for the alpha 1, as well as for the alpha 2. So now when a goes to 0, so when you are approaching the singularity, these terms that are the kinetic energy terms are going to be the dominant ones because all other terms have factors of a in the numerator, whereas these guys have factors of a in the denominator when the momentum happens to be non-zero. Okay, so for that reason, the potentials for both, for all the fields, become unimportant as you approach the singularity. And therefore, it becomes kinetic energy dominated. So it becomes a much simpler thing to solve. So because there are no potentials also, close to the singularity, these momenta turn into constants. So they get conserved in the motion through the singularity as constants, because the potentials are not affecting them when you are very close to the singularity. So now we transform that to the gamma gauge, and then find the solution of how you go through the singularity. So the solution turns out to be unique. So I wrote it down here. One important thing to notice is the form of this gauge invariant quantity, which was proportional to phi squared minus s squared, as a function of time in the solution. It is a linear term in tau, in time, and then a quadratic term. And it is, while the other things have various analyticity singularities, so namely cuts in the tau plane, this one has no cuts whatsoever, and it is analytic. And this is an important factor in how we solve the equation through the singularity by keeping the analyticity properties of this function, of this gauge invariant function. So then these functions then look like this. So chi, which is this proportional to phi squared minus s squared, is coming down from being a large number, is coming down until it hits zero. So that's the crunch. That's when the universe is of zero size. Then it continues as a negative number. So this is when phi squared minus s squared is negative. So there is anti-gravity during this period of time. And then it reemerges again. And then this is the Big Bang. And then it goes on and becomes a large universe. So this is this function I'm just plotting. The parameters in this function, what is controlling this shape, is p, which is the square root of the momenta, p of sigma and of the anisotropies. And then the other parameter in this equation is rho. It is the radiation parameter. So none of these are negligible. Okay, neither this parameter nor that parameter are negligible close to the singularity. So there is matter, close to the singularity, there is anisotropy close to the singularity, and there is radiation close to the singularity. So none of these are negligible. So therefore, this must happen. It is also independent of the potential. As I argued, the kinetic terms were dominating, and therefore the potentials are unimportant. So this is going to happen in every model. So this is a model-independent result as well. So this must happen as far as classical gravity is concerned. Now, quantum gravity may modify some of this, but as far as classical gravity is concerned, this must happen. Yeah?
If you include the higher power terms, then higher power terms
Let me... So let me mention that. So now, what happens now when you have anti-gravity? When you have anti-gravity, then you are able to emit negative energy gravitons.
Graviton has a negative kinetic term.
Has what?
Graviton has a negative kinetic.
That's what I'm saying. So exactly. Because no, it's not a ghost. It just means negative energy. It doesn't mean ghost. So you can keep unitarity, and then it only means negative energy. It does not mean ghost. So therefore, what will happen is that you are going to emit profusely. You will begin to emit negative energy gravitons. But that, because of the zero energy condition, has to be matched also profusely by emitting a lot of radiation, a lot of matter, to balance the energy. So when you do that, you will change drastically. Please let me finish this. You will change drastically the parameter rho, because rho was radiation. So the moment you do that, you look at how long is the anti-gravity period. We calculated that. It is the ratio of P over rho. So if you profusely emit radiation, this period of anti-gravity just shrinks. And so therefore, there is some physics that has to happen, which we are not discussing, but we are getting a glimpse of what should be happening, that the theory will try to prevent it. Okay?
So if you write down the action, I mean, correlative action for tensor mode, then the coefficient of kinetic term just flip, and so it is ghost.
I'm sorry, but it is not ghost.
What's the difference between ghost and negative energy?
Well, ghost is negative norm, which is unitarity problem. Negative energy is that there is no bottom. And it's different physics. It's not the same.
I don't think they're different. I think they're different symptoms of the same problem.
Well, okay. Okay, no, but the thing is that you have to preserve unitarity. If you don't preserve unitarity, then you are in bigger trouble. So because then it is really sick. When it is negative energy, then there is real physics that should happen, which is what I'm just saying.
It's not negative energy, it's unitary theory. The bound state of hydrogen is negative energy.
No, but it's not bounded from below. That's why ghosts are bad.
Well, okay, but I'm telling you, okay, what we expect to happen. So now we are not going to resolve this. Okay, it's clear we are not going to resolve this because this is the solution. It is unique. We are not going to resolve this without going beyond. Now, to be able to go beyond, you really need quantum gravity. And, everyone is invited to figure out what should happen. What is the detail of what should happen?
But did you try to check what about the cosmological perturbations in such models?
We didn't do that yet. But this is part of what Jan is saying. Partially we did, and this is partially what Jan is trying to say. That we see already from the solution, we see already that the period of anti-gravity is proportional to 1 over rho. Now, we have been treating rho as being a constant, okay, that radiation is a constant. So it is under that assumption that this is the solution. Now, but it's not going to be a constant from the discussion I just gave. So the theory will try automatically try to shorten this period. But exactly what the detail is going to be, how it's going to shorten it, which physics is going to happen, is completely not understood. It's completely open, and it's worth investigating.
because in this cosmological perturbation is you can actually understand the behavior of all the modes, the tensors, vectors, and the scalars, so you can understand better what does it mean to have a negative energy, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. But this is also, it's by starting that discussion that I'm getting what I'm just telling you, that you preserve unitarity, so then you get negative energy modes for the tensor modes, you will, but then that means you can emit profusely negative, because there is no bottom, you can emit them. But then there is a zero energy condition. The zero energy condition will require that matter also should be emitted. But then when that happens, rho will drastically go up. The moment this wants to happen, then matter also will drastically go up, and then they will have to fight with one another. So that detail is open.
Actually, if I may comment a moment, that linear theory, you don't, at linear level, tensors decouple from a scalar, so you don't actually see any Gauss problem, because the Gauss problem is coupling of negative and positive energy modes. But if they don't couple to each other, which is the case at linear level, then you're not going to see that.
Right, not at the linear level, you have to allow the interaction and all such processes. All right, so now, but this looks like in the phi S plane. Remember, I was showing you a very complicated curve before. But now this solution turns out to be an attractor solution. It takes phi and S, wherever they start from, it attracts it to the origin. And then it forces them to go into an anti-gravity loop and then come back. So the shape of the shape and size of this anti-gravity loop is controlled just by the anisotropy parameters, which are the momenta, and the kinetic energy, which is the sigma, and the radiation. These are the parameters that control the shape and size of that loop. Now, notice that if there is anisotropy, even a tiny bit of amount of anisotropy, even if it is very, very, very small, this solution is going to happen. Only if there is no anisotropy, it's possible to avoid it. So namely, the size of this loop can shrink to zero. It's possible for that to shrink to zero if there is zero anisotropy. But the moment there is even any infinitesimal amount of anisotropy, you cannot avoid it. All right. So I have to.
So you go from gravity to anti-gravity.
And back to gravity.
Only through the center.
Only through the center, and this is this attractor. It goes only through the center. So this curve, because of anisotropy, becomes that curve, a much simpler curve. All right, so I already said all of these things, that this is unavoidable. It is generic, it is unique, it is model independent. So the universe contracts, passes briefly through some anti-gravity period, and then expands again. Now, similar phenomena really should be studied now more fully in quantum gravity, in particular string theory. And for starters, you can consider these solutions that I have just mentioned as being as interpreted as solutions for a string background, because the string background solutions for the conformal conditions of string theory, which is the perturbative beta function equal to zero, are exactly the same set of solutions, the same set of equations. So therefore, you can consider these solutions as being a string background in which you try to understand the quantum version in string theory. So we haven't done that. So the things we learned so far is that we found techniques based on conformal symmetry, which led to this attractor mechanism and a unique solution with anti-gravity being unavoidable. And then I mentioned this in the very beginning, that this is typical supergravity, because this kind of factor in front of R is quite typical in supergravity. So all this sort of thing does happen in supergravity. We did solve also supergravity models with their additional fields that are needed also in supergravity, and the same kind of behavior does happen also in supergravity. In the discussions of supergravity, it was always assumed in the past, it was an assumption, that such terms are much smaller compared to the Einstein-Hilbert term. And under that assumption, of course, it was positive, and it was thought that supergravity never does this, but supergravity does this. the same set of solutions also occur in supergravity, so it is very generic. It's not an isolated model in which this is happening. It's typical. Now, we also studied the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which takes some quantum into account. But this is basically, it gives you the same results. We managed to solve it also. At some of the cases, depending on which parameters we keep exactly, or if we keep everything semi-classically, and we get the same conclusion. So as far as Wheeler-DeWitt is concerned, no changes as far as the picture is concerned. So is this insight going to survive full quantum theory? Maybe yes, maybe not. But maybe what is going on is that we can consider what is happening, the analog of the Klein paradox in ordinary field theory. I don't know if you remember the Klein paradox, but basically it indicates that at the classical level, when you try to solve the field theory at the classical level in the presence of strong fields, that the equations become inconsistent. So this is what it looks like, the equations becoming inconsistent. But actually what happens is that you begin to emit pairs of, say, electron, anti-electron, positron pairs. And so the real physics is that, and you get to understand it only when you do the quantum version of that field theory. But still, the Klein paradox is actually an indication of some real physics happening. And that real physics happening, in fact, has been used in recent years in this graphite problem that got the Nobel Prize. They use exactly the solutions of the Klein paradox in order to get physical results. So again, even though it may appear what I'm saying, with this negative energy gravitons and so on, it may appear maybe as a problem, it actually may be just an indication of some solution which is capturing some kind of physics that is going on, and then it may still be a useful solution in order to actually do something with it. But of course, we will not fully understand it until we understand quantum gravity. So quite open is what are some of the observational effects of a possible anti-gravity period in the past. This is, of course, a very important project. Some people are starting to get interested in that and think about it, including ourselves, but we have not had enough time to really do a good job on that. But it's something which could be investigated at the phenomenological level. Now, if you want me to stop, I will stop, but then I will not be able to tell you about how all this is connected to the hierarchy problem. So.
Well, there were a lot of questions during the talk already. So.
Right, but this is another topic. I mean, this continuation is using the same solutions.
Are there questions to the talk so far?
Okay.
Just one comment on something else you need to worry about with the negative energy gravitational perturbations, which is that the theory, the full energy of those perturbations is going to be very nonlinear. And there's no guarantee that what the higher order terms are going to look like. So your energy balance doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be producing other particles. It may mean that you're producing complicated nonlinearities in the gravitational field, which would presumably then could mess up this picture.
Without really doing a serious job, I cannot really answer these things. But one effort that we have been making is to try to solve these equations in the complex tau plane. By going around the loop, around the singularity, in order to connect data from before the crunch to data to after the crunch, without ever touching the singularity. So by solving it in the complex tau plane. So if that loop around the singularity is sufficiently large, then you can forget about quantum corrections, and right, because it then the equations are believable without taking into account the quantum corrections, because gravity will never become strong, sufficiently strong, if you solve the same set of equations in the complex tau plane by going around, you know, sufficient with it in a circle which is sufficiently large. And then this will become, well, this becomes a useful tool in order to connect data from before the crunch to after the crunch, which is of extreme interest for those people that do cyclic cosmology. So this is one way in which you can still try to use this as a result without needing to deal with additional effects.
But these aren't quantum corrections. I just said, even classically, if you have a negative coupling constant for gravity.
But this, I'm sorry, I guess you didn't understand. You did not understand what I just said. You go around the singularity, you never go into the anti-gravity regime.
Oh, never go into the anti-gravity
regime. Never go into
regime.
The gravity regime. Right.
Oh, okay.
By solving it, By solving it in the complex tau plane, so you never go, you never touch the singularity, you never go into the anti-gravity,
okay.
And you just use the data to solve it in the complex plane, and then therefore avoid the questions.
So in that case, the Newton constant is real or complex?
Is what?
In that case, the Newton constant is complex or real?
No, it's real. Phi squared remains larger than S squared. Right. So if you solve it like that, then it always remains larger. So you can use that in order to connect data from before the crunch to data after the crunch. So it still is can be used as a useful tool.
So people are getting hungry, so how much time would you need?
Maybe I can go very fast, okay? Just to tell you the ideas without explaining the details. So puzzles that have puzzled me for a long time, and I guess everyone else. Now, the universe is filled uniformly with dark energy, but it is also filled uniformly with the Higgs vacuum, according to the standard model. Are these different or are they closely related? Now, another puzzle is that the standard model presents the electroweak phase transition as being spontaneous without having any relation at all to gravity. But this doesn't make sense. It is not physically sensible to expect that the entire universe will undergo a phase transition. It needs to be understood. It makes more sense to understand it as a phase transition in the, as the cosmology of the universe develops. So, and then if it happens like that, then it is not, the standard model is not independent of gravity because cosmology connects them. Then the third question is how the hierarchy of the electroweak versus the Planck scale, how can it get generated? Can it get generated dynamically? All right, so I have a suggestion, a rough idea for how these can be answered. And it is based on the general features of the exact solutions for cosmology, in which I will include also the Higgs, and I will look at the history of the Higgs itself in cosmology. So this is the idea. So for that, I need to complete the coupling of the Higgs field and the standard model to gravity, and then coming from the principles I mentioned before, either you can say because of Weyl symmetry or because of two-time physics, the coupling of the Higgs to R also is exactly like the other scalars. I'm going to neglect adding additional scalars like the S I mentioned before in order to keep the discussion simple, just to give the idea. And there are no dimensionful constants at all in this language. But of course, if I begin to choose the gauge in which phi is a constant, then that term in the regime when the Higgs field is much, much smaller compared to the Planck scale, in that regime, I can consider this term to be basically the gravitational constant, and I can neglect that in the estimate of the gravitational constant. So if I choose then that gauge in which this guy is a constant, then this term over here becomes the cosmological constant, and this term over there becomes the electroweak scale. So if I formulate it like that, and also this term goes away, so the Gauss goes away, So if I formulate it in this way, clearly the dark matter issue, the electroweak scale, and the gravitational scale, they are all connected to one another. They are all connected to the same field. So very naive statement. Now, let me start from that. And then in order to see that this is, by the way, in the case in which I neglect the size of H as compared to the size of phi, right? So in that regime, it looks like the usual standard model coupled to gravity. And then you neglect gravity, and you remain with the usual standard model with a very small, assuming a very small, dark energy term. So formulated in this way, it would seem like there is no coupling. But this is because I neglected the size of H as compared to phi. But remember this attractor mechanism, which I mentioned. The attractor mechanism also will operate on the H as well. So starting at the very small sizes of the universe, H will be just as big as the phi. They will go together to zero. So this is required from this discussion. So therefore, they really start out of equal size, and then they begin to grow. So now let me look, therefore, at the evolution of these fields by taking only these fields as functions of time. So this is the same action rewritten only for time-dependent fields, where I have allowed the radiation constant to represent, in the dust approximation, to represent all the kinetic energies of all particles. I added a linear term in the Higgs, which is a linear coupling of the Higgs with an unknown coupling in front, which is related to the Yukawa couplings. But I wrote it in a way that is still wide invariant. And then finally, there is an additional S squared term, a quadratic term of the Higgs, which comes from the coupling to the W and the Z. Okay, with another unknown parameter. These unknown parameters are parameters in the cosmological state of the universe. So they are supposed to be computed in the cosmological state of the universe. So now, furthermore, if I take the Higgs and use the put it in the unitary gauge under SU2 cross U1, it has only a single real field, which I can take it to be positive. So that I will call it S for the purpose of this discussion, and then it gives you exactly the system that I was discussing before, with some additional parameters that I can put in. It does not change the discussion of how the solutions go. So I will skip quickly. So because we have all the solutions, I can begin to take a look at what they look like. See if I have a picture. Right. So here is how they will look like. It will be this case, the B positive, because the cosmological constant is positive. So it's the B positive case. So S will oscillate with a finite maximum size, while phi will keep growing. But this is exactly what you need for the Higgs to stay small for all of its oscillations. Okay, for all of its oscillations, it's going to stay small. And in the meantime, phi will grow to cosmological sizes. So this can be seen directly from the solutions. So these are the time-dependent factors, but there is an overall constant in front of it that depends on the B parameter and the C parameter. So if you look at the ratio of these amplitudes, they go like this. And then if you assume B is 10 to the minus 120, the cosmological constant, and C of order 1, the energies of order 1, that the ratio of order 1, then you come up with a very, very tiny ratio, 10 to the minus 30, which is even smaller, much smaller than what is required. So at the very naive level, it's not difficult at all to cosmologically reach a stage in which the Higgs is not large, simply cannot become large, because the cosmological solution, the entire solution of the universe put together, does not allow it to become large. And what makes the Higgs, what makes the phi much larger than S is related to the smallness of the cosmological constant. So I'm not explaining why the cosmological constant is small, but taking that the cosmological constant is small, then a small electroweak scale comes out dynamically, can come out dynamically. I'm not saying, I have not done all of this in great detail and fit it and so on, but this is a very rough germ of an idea, which I think can explain how hierarchies can emerge. So basically that's the idea. So I will stop here.
So one quick announcement is, I was just told that lunch will be in the ground floor, not the first floor.
There's a question.
Huh? So there is one question.
Yes.
So if I actually now want to look at each quanta.
At that?
A quanta of the
of the Higgs. Yes.
So I can see what I'm going to measure the LHT.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like it matches up the parameters.
That's the next
slide.
How the double well emerges. So if you look at all the terms, the potential, the effective potential that the Higgs sees contains this S squared minus phi squared with some small parameter in front of it. And then the other terms, which are not going to affect the discussion too much. So now, when the universe is small, phi is as small as S. So this term is small. It doesn't dominate the other one. So therefore, this entire potential just looks like this. It's very early in the universe. So I'm putting phi equal to 0 to represent what is it that the Higgs sees. So the Higgs wants to be at as far as its lowest state is concerned, the vacuum state of the Higgs is concerned, it is fairly small. Now, as time passes, phi grows. So then the shape of this potential reaches a point where these guys become comparable. So then there is a minimum still, which is a little bit lower than the other one. Then as phi grows beyond that, so that's a curve. You begin to reach a curve like this, where that initial minimum has now become larger as compared to this minimum. And the reason, of course, is now phi is sufficiently large such that this term, because it is squared at S equal to 0, so this is plotted versus S, at S equal to 0 gives you some value, which is there. But then as S goes larger, well, you have another minimum. So now phi is now currently varying very, very slowly. So because its time scale is controlled by that parameter b. So its time scale is very, very slow. So currently, it is moving very, very slowly. So therefore, the Higgs just chooses to stay at its minimum and then oscillate, of course, around it. So excitations of the Higgs will be around that minimum. But those excitations will never become very large, because I just was showing you what the solution looks like as a function of time. Okay, so.
The curvature of that minimum is fixed by some parameter.
It's fixed by this parameter, yeah. I mean, this parameter is still very small. Right. That parameter is a parameter in the theory, which you fix it. So when phi reaches, say, Planck scales, that parameter is really tiny, such that the combination of these two guys is of order 250 GeV by design, you know, by making it like that. Now, this is a very crude model. It didn't have to be that what I put here is phi. If I have more scalars, it could be some other scalar in the evolution of the universe. So as far as this mechanism is concerned, it can be controlled by not necessarily a phi which will become very, very large, but it can be some other scalar that is not necessarily going to become as large as the Planck scale. But the main thing is not so much how this is occurring, but more like what is the amplitude of the Higgs? How big can the Higgs ever become? And so that ratio is controlled by dark energy. So because of the interactions of Higgs with phi. And so this is how phi can, I mean, the Higgs can never become very large. And this is the reason, that's the main reason for why there is this big gap of energies.
So as your Higgs evolves cosmologically, the masses of everything else that get their masses through what you call a couplings are going to change as well.
Right.
Do you get it to the right constant value early enough to not mess up Big Bang nucleosynthesis?
Well, these are good questions. You know, as I said, this is a very, very early stage, very crude idea at this point. I mean, I will not be able to tell you details like that. But, I mean, you can use it as a starting point, and then hopefully you can make it work cosmologically, yeah, in detail. So I hope that, but I don't have it today.
I think we should really...
Yeah, Richard. Okay. So last question.
Okay.
My question was answered by Stephen.
So are you trying to say that actually this extra conformal symmetry that you start with is the one responsible for the stabilization of the mass of the Higgs?
No, really. I mean, it's a model for stabilizing it. If I don't have a mechanism like this extra term, if I don't have that, although the amplitude of the Higgs is not large, so I have already established that it's not going to be, that the electroweak scale is not going to be of the Planck scale because of cosmology. I have already established that, but the Higgs is still oscillating around zero. So what stabilizes it to oscillate around the constant? So you need an additional mechanism. So I'm mimicking with this. How does the double well, how does the Mexican hot potential emerge? So that's an additional model. So it could emerge, say, Coleman-Weinberg type of correction, logarithmic correction to the s to the fourth, also will do it. So, I mean, there can be other ways in which it can happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.